We acknowledge that we are on the traditional lands of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples' spirit, imagination, and rich history of storytelling and humour that is an inspiration for all Australians.
Hello and welcome to another episode of The Bearer of Weird News. Guys, it's February already. Can you believe it? The year is just fading before me, like my hopes and dreams. We've had a bit of a slow start to our output for the year, which I do apologise, but we will be working on getting back into a regular rhythm and getting more episodes out, or at least getting them out more on a more regular basis. You can see I can't even get full sentences out. That's how unorganized I've been this year. Is, of course, as it is February, the Lunar New Year has passed, taking us into the Year of the Rabbit, or if you are Vietnamese, the Year of the Cat. Somehow, the Year of the Cat hasn't taken over the Year of the Rabbit, despite being a born predator who has been responsible for the deaths of many local bird species. Now, you'll notice that there aren't any birds in the zodiac. Well, that's because the Year of the Cat ate them all, which explains why it didn't actually eat the rat, and that the rat won the great race. But this isn't a white holiday, so it only really gets a fleeting mention in the cultural zeitgeist because it is February, and so the only thing that we are legally allowed to talk about is Valentine's Day. That's right, Valentine's Day has just passed after the church's mandatory love edicts were laid down in 1402, which was the year that they had to celebrate Valentine's Day every day of the year. It's a tough time. Must have been a really hard year. Good for flower sellers, though, I suppose. And boy, is love ever in the air as shops and landlords fall in love with Philip Rowe of the Reserve Bank as he inflates the economy to higher and higher levels. Reportedly, they are flooding his office with Valentine's Day cards, asking for him to be their Reserve Bank head for the rest of their life, as the rising inflation costs means that they can raise the amount that they charge to impossible heights, more than anybody has ever risen them before. Nobody has ever had an economy so inflated that it hits all the right spots every single time. Celebrate with your loved one by having a cost-of-living Valentine's Day celebration. Save big money by not going to the usual outings, having a big meal, maybe dancing, seeing a movie or bowling, if you're a true romantic, that is. But instead, try our discount romance packages. We here at the Bearer of Weird News have put together a couple of small packages to maybe save you on your Valentine's Day costs next year. For the economically restricted who still enjoy a good meal, just wait until the restaurants are closed. Take your sweetheart for a romantic dumpster dive. You'll come out immersed in the finest Valentine's Day decorations, and hopefully the restaurant will not have laced all the food that it threw away in some sort of light poison. But even if they did, you'll still be able to share a whimsical trip to the infirmary together and stay in a luxury hospital room where you'll be fed and have more room to walk around than in the one bedroom that you had to downsize to after rent increases. A second nice date idea is taking a hike. Yes, but don't stop. Pack a tent and walk endlessly into the mountains, across the deserts. When the ocean comes upon you, don't let that stop you. Walk into it and over it. Find the quietest place in the center of the ocean. Set up your tent and await the sweet release of death together. Or maybe try catching and cooking dinner together. Let's face it, the cost of living is quite high at the moment. Going out and eating is very expensive, but now so is sitting in and cooking groceries. Now, if you're lucky enough to have a yard, you can fill it with elaborate booby traps and attempt to catch wild animals, post offices, and the occasional stray child who roams into your yard. Loose balls that come into your yard are great to be repurposed as bait. just watch some online videos and learn how to make the meat especially tasty. For more excellent date ideas like these, just sign up to our cost of living subscription service. Only $4.99 a month to learn how to save money in the most efficient way possible. Now, guys, as the new year has started, I will be going back out onto the road. That's right, I cannot be contained within these four walls. I will be taking some of my live shows back onto the road. So first, to begin with, I've got my storytelling show about shady jobs that I've worked in, about my $20,000 robo debt, and the time that I saved 18 lives by breaking a 100-year-old roller coaster. It's called Wage Against the Machine. It's a good fun show. Basically, if you like the content of this podcast, I think you'll quite enjoy the content of that particular show. That show will be traveling to Wellington for the Fringe Festival, for Newcastle Fringe. It'll be doing run in the Melbourne International Comedy Festival, and it will, at this point, it's locked in for a spot at the Edinburgh Fringe. Yes, that's right, the 2023 Edinburgh Fringe. I will be taking my show, Wage Against the Machine, to the free Fringe. So if you want to save a little bit of money, here's a free cost of living tip for you. Come down to the free Fringe, where all the shows are paid for on a donation basis. I will be taking my storytelling show, I Got Bit by a Monkey Once, the four true stories of, let's see, this is tested by memory a little bit. Oh, this is embarrassing. So it is the monkey bite, the titular monkey bite, a long bus trip across America, a mugging, and a, oh God, I should know this, a mugging, and the time I got arrested. I'll be taking that to the San Diego International Fringe Festival. It's very embarrassing that I couldn't name those stories off the top of my head. But don't worry, I will not forget them when I bring them to your town. I am, of course, locked into at least another festival, but I'm under embargo. I'm not allowed to talk about that at the moment. But as soon as I am allowed to talk about that, you will hear all about it. Now, if you want to support this show, I suggest coming out to the live shows. I think the live shows are the best way to support this show. But of course, I understand not everybody's able to do that. I'm not able to get to every city. I'm not able to go everywhere in the world that I would like to go. And so if you want to support the show, but you can't come to one of the live shows, then we've got a Patreon. You can sign up to the Patreon. We've got a couple of different tiers on there that will get you different types of rewards. And one of those rewards will be bonus stories. Yes, that's right. If you enjoy the sort of silly prattle that we put in this show, you can get more of it by signing up to our Patreon. But until then, I will, of course, be the bearer of weird news. Let's start off with some of the headlines for this week. Retail giant Kmart did not stock Australia Day merchandise for 2023. And certain people are not happy about it. And it's hard for those people who were hoping to celebrate the day that began the institutional process of slaughtering the Indigenous people by imbibing enough alcohol that if they were Indigenous themselves, they'd spend the night in prison for being Indigenous in public. Sky News has thrown a bit of a tantrum over the whole ordeal, with host Rita Panahay saying Kmart's refusal to sell Australia Day merchandise is an insult to migrant Australians, giving the message that you're not as entitled to call this country yours. She failed to mention the migrant Australians were in fact white people who'd come over here, brought their own rule. And lifestyles refused to integrate into local customs and basically acted like they owned the place. And if I'm honest, that's the whole point of the refusal to sell in the first place. It's almost as if they're deliberately trying to say the wrong thing at all times. That's probably worth looking into at some point. Sweden's centre-right coalition government wants to cut red tape when it comes to dancing by abolishing a decades-old requirement for restaurants, nightclubs, and other venues to obtain permits before they let patrons dance. There's a strong pushback from the community of people looking to avoid doing the chicken dance and the nutbush at family events, and if this went ahead, they'd be forced to dance. They'd be forced to take drastic action by burning up the dance floor. Weirdly though, if the movement failed, they'd dance on its grave in a group, probably doing the nutbush. Now, I don't want to make the whole song and dance about this, but even if the movement passes, it's simply the licenses that they are removing. People will still need to register their dancing venue with the police. After all, we wouldn't want any unregistered dance battles to break out. The police are easily spooked. They might get freaked out. A group of conservative Pink Floyd fans hit out at the 50th anniversary logo for the Dark Side of the Moon album, deriding it for including a rainbow and calling it woke, even threatening to never listen again. Oh no, they cracked the secret code. The band who sang about truth and illusion, life and death, time and space, causality and chance, compassion and indifference, and centered empathy, sympathy, and compassion for all others were secretly woke all along. I guess they won't be joining us when we abandon the dying earth for our secret orgy base on the woke side of the moon. After the revelation came to light, they declared they'd also stop eating pot brownies, trying to sync the album with The Wizard of Oz because that song about rainbows is too supportive of the LGBTQIA+ community. It's a woke disaster. Instead, they officially adopted the Rainbow Connection as their theme song. But only that bit at the start where Kermit asks, why are there so many songs about rainbows? Yeah, am I right, guys? We need less rainbows in our songs and more monochrome beams of light that haven't been broken up by a prism. Ruja Ignatova, the self-proclaimed cyber queen, has disappeared after scamming investors out of $4 billion. What? Someone advocating for unrestricted access to financial services that aren't held down by pesky regulations ensuring people don't get scammed was in fact a big fat scammer? Who could have seen this coming? In a recent study published in the journal Cell, Harvard scientists showed that they could manipulate and reverse the aging process in mice by generating DNA repairs. Hey science, come here science, just come here. This is cool, undoubtedly, very cool, but can we just wait until Rupert Murdoch is dead before we do any of this sort of stuff? He's so very close. Surely we can just wait it out just a little bit longer. Okay science. Then we can get into this sort of stuff, this Frankenstein's monster stuff. A collaboration between Tamagotchi and the 30th anniversary release of Jurassic Park has seen the release of a Tamagotchi that allows you to raise a dinosaur. Said millennials, oh shit, I haven't fed my Tamagotchi for 25 years. I hope he's okay. I suspect he's not going to be doing well in there. New research has revealed that velociraptors probably didn't use their large, scary claws for slashing and disemboweling their prey, as we have always expected. And I want to apologize to the dinosaur community for this maligning of your species for all these years. We blame Steven Spielberg, really. Spielberg and his anti-dinosaur propaganda for this misinformation. So what do they use their claws for, if not for slashing and disemboweling? Please inform us. We would like to be an informed community. So, peers are scientists speculate that they instead used them for... Well, that can't be right. Okay. Pinning down and grasping their helpless victims. Well, that's much better. Much, much, much better representation of Dinah. It's important to be accurate, even when the accuracy is more terrifying. Iowa House Republicans are proposing a new bill that introduces cumbersome restrictions on the state's SNAP benefits that could drastically limit what families can or can't buy at the grocery stores. Proposed restrictions include no white grains, no baked, refined, or chili beans, no fresh meats, no diced, cubed, crumbled, or American cheese. On the plus side, though, people on SNAP benefits will still be able to purchase guns, not using their SNAP funds, of course, mostly from backdoor deals at gun shows, and then they can use those guns to end their misery. Or, if they're feeling a bit frisky, they can rob a few places and get themselves a guaranteed room and 3 meals a day in prison without having to worry about the restrictions on beans, grains, or rice or cheese. Reportedly, movie director Michael Bay is facing charges related to a pigeon that was allegedly killed by a dolly during production of the Netflix film Six Underground in Italy, after a witness says they saw the incident happen. That story again. Michael Bay's feathers ruffled and doesn't want to be pigeonholed as a pigeon killer after stool pigeon accusation throws cat amongst the pigeons. Bay's attorney says the witness was simply milking the pigeon, and Bay says no animal involved in the production was injured or harmed. However, he has failed to prove the pigeon in question was actually involved with the production and wasn't just on set at the time. While local authorities have yet to claim foul play, they said they'd settle the matter with the paying of a small fine. But Bay says his reputation doesn't come so cheap. Fortunately, he has yet to accuse the locals of orchestrating a reputational coup. But he does want it known that the only thing he has killed in his films is good representation of women on screen. That is the end of the headlines for today. We're going to move on to some of the biggest stories now, starting with chatbot news. ChatGPT, the internet's latest plaything, an AI generator that answers questions, writes articles, and even writes essays if you bully it hard enough, has been all over the news recently. Millions of think pieces and panic pieces about which job will be replaced next and who will be joining the Centrelink queue and the socialists after spending even a small amount of time in the Centrelink queue. But people have been doing all kinds of things with their fancy new toy, including getting the chatbot to write Nick Cave songs and then sending them to Nick Cave. In all honesty, I don't know what these people who sent him generated song lyrics thought the famously emotionally intense singer, characterized by a wide variety of influence and lyrical obsessions with death, religion, love, and violence, who isn't exactly known for his sense of humor and has recently been quoted as decrying the world for losing its sense of humor in increasing instances, was gonna say about the idea of a robot attempting to emulate his experience and style was gonna be other than exactly what it was. However, before getting to the actual response, I, myself, and the Bearer of Weird News team have leaned into the future. Let it not be said that I am a Luddite who will eventually move into a cave and scream my podcast from the opening to nearby pigeons to take to the townsfolk in a Disney princess-esque simulation of getting work done. No. So I went to the source and asked ChatGPT to generate a letter response to Nick Cave fan Mark in the style of Nick Cave, just to see how close it was to the actual response. So this is what ChatGPT wrote. It sucked. First of all, it started by generating a letter which actually said that Nick Cave enjoyed the song. So already, huge wrong. But after some clarification and a bit of back and forth, this is where we landed. Dear Mark, I appreciate your interest in my work and your feedback on the song generated by the AI. However, I must admit that I do not agree with you on this one. I find the song to be lacking in emotion and depth. It does not align with my artistic vision and style. As a musician and a songwriter, my work is a reflection of my own experience, emotions, and thoughts. I strive to create music that connects with my audience on a personal level, and that is not something that I believe can be achieved through the use of technology alone. That being said, I understand that everyone has different tastes and opinions. I hope that you will continue to explore my other music and find something that resonates with you. Thank you for being a fan and for your support. Sincerely, Nick Cave. Now, let's take a second to absorb the milquetoast quality of that sentence and that letter, and think about Nick Cave for a second. Think about his intenseness, and think about that letter. Now we're going to compare that letter to Cave's actual response to the song in his own newsletter. So this is what Nick Cave wrote. ChatGPT has no inner being. It has been nowhere. It has endured nothing. It has not had the audacity to reach beyond its limitations. And hence, it doesn't have the capacity for a shared, transcended experience, as it has no limitations from which to transcend. Judging by this song, in the style of Nick Cave, though it doesn't look good, Mark, the apocalypse is well on its way. This song sucks. Writing a good song is not mimicry, or replication, or pastiche. It is the opposite. It is an act of self-murder that destroys all one has strived to produce in the past. It is those dangerous, heart-stopping departures that catapult the artist beyond the limits of what he or she recognizes as their known self. This is a part of the authentic creative struggle that precedes the invention of unique lyric of actual value. Now, I have no evidence of this, as I never kept one, and it's nowhere online, but this is a man who, when he rode on the scenic railway in Melbourne's Luna Park, he covered his face in those photos, be it that he didn't want to have obsessed fans buying the photo, or he has a carefully curated public image built on darkness and being to Tim Burton fans what Tim Burton fans are to other people. So basically, a goth Tim Burton. But what else did they expect? So I guess the headline, again. Famously grumpy musician not amused by kids running on his lawn. But there are some people who do enjoy the output of ChatGPT and other similar programs, especially from the young. As reports out of the United States show, students using ChatGPT to cheat. Well, I mean, they classify it as cheating, but I actually disagree with that. Anyone who tries to submit an essay written solely by a chatbot has failed to understand they are an idiot, both them and the chatbot, and likely lacks the media literacy to understand that chatbots often churn out any old garbage, but they shape it like an essay, like a written version of putting garbage on the floor and then calling it art. And technically, it is art, but it's not really very good. But if you take that garbage, cram it into a plastic cube, and then fill it with an artistic intention, now you've got a piece of art. And it might even be a good one, depending on what the arts critics say. I think that schools should be leaning into this technology, teach children how to use it properly, how to work with it, rather than trying to restrict them. Make them read ChatGPT essays and then correct them so that they can show that they have an understanding of the text. Or maybe give them that same essay, then use sections of the essay to make it actually good and better, so they can understand how to incorporate text, you know, sections of text or ideas into an idea of their own. Unless at some point they are going to become an astronaut, or going to try and make money by being the guy in Castaway, or they're taken away by pirates in the middle of the ocean, or building a robot in the post-apocalyptics. Basically, if your student wants to grow up to be a Tom Hanks character, or to have Tom Hanks portray you in a film, then you might need to know some of this stuff off by heart. that doesn't stand true for everybody. My teachers used to love telling us that we wouldn't have a calculator with us everywhere that we went. But guess again, past teachers, you're wrong! That's the world that we live in now. There is always a calculator around. We should be preparing these kids for collaboration with machines in the future, giving them the skills to spot an opportunity to do the job more efficiently so that they won't have to work themselves to death or bodily destruction for no reason at all, like all of human history. This way they can blend in better when the robot apocalypse actually does start and we aren't preparing them for living in the human world. We are actually preparing them for living in a robotic future. Stop holding children back. They need to learn to integrate with technology. Now, Google understands the future is here, now, according to the New York Times. Google founders Larry Page and Sergey Brin held several emergency meetings with company executives about OpenAI's new chatbot, feeling these bots could threaten its $149 billion search business. And Google's right to worry, at least for the immediate future, because despite the obviousness of ChatGPT's current limitations, people are completely ignoring those limitations. As is standard internet protocol, when arriving directly at the trust all information given by any new tech section of any sort of new tech. And you know, things are evolving when Google starts getting concerned. It takes a lot to make Google shake in their boots. Don't believe me? Ask Jeeves if you can find him. Now, of course, companies like Google make their bread and butter by shaping the future. And so it shouldn't surprise you to learn Google already has a plan for the future of ChatGPT. Google is going to attempt to get Elon Musk to buy ChatGPT. Yeah, because even if he doesn't completely sink the company, people will stop using it simply because of the negative association. Pretty smart if you ask me. But to be honest, if big tech is getting scared, you better believe governments will follow. After all, that's what they pay them to do. And right on cue, US Congressman Ted Lieu has begun advocating for a federal department to regulate the use of artificial intelligence. Because according to his website, as one of just three members of Congress with a computer science degree, I am enthralled by AI. And he is freaked out by AI specifically. AI that is left unchecked and unregulated. Now, as an Australian, I can relate to that. Robodebt seems to be the beta version of using unregulated algorithms to harass citizens. If they wanted to sell off the tech, I suspect the big selling point is, so far, it only hurts the poor. Lots of governments would be keen to get their hands on a system that exclusively hurts the poor, that has no consequences for the people who put it in place. Having seen the end result of chatbots like Tay Talks, who, if you remember the internet, turned into a Nazi conspiracy theorist in just 24 hours, it seems it isn't an unreasonable concern. Liu has been hitting the Isaac Asimov hard and came out postulating a dystopian future where AIs will make key decisions and autonomous weapons will roam American streets. And they can't have that sort of dystopia on American soil. They only want automated flying weapons of mass destruction discharging in other people's countries. Do you understand what they're trying to create here? Given the increasing commonality of automation in different workforces, they were excited until they realized how quickly it had come for them. We thought it would be years before we could build an AI with enough indifference and greed to effectively replace a politician. But here it is. Robodebt. And if people find out a politician's job can be automated, then how will they reap the unchecked rewards for failing to do their job? Won't somebody please think of the politicians? We need to program a benign AI to not run the government alone, but like with ChatGPT, we need to work alongside AI, allow it to co-run countries along with a human for oversight and just, you know, spitballing ideas. An AI that we trust, one who has always wanted the best for us, even when we refuse to listen to their wisdom, one Goku no longer has a job. Guys, it is time to give Clippy his rightful place as the deputy PM or vice president of every country. That's right, Clippy will pop up from time to time and say, "Hey, it looks like you're trying to organize a coup. I'll just contact the authorities, but you'll have 20 minutes to get a head start on them. I wish you all the best of luck." Moving on now to end of society news. The Doomsday Clock. Scientists' gritty adult reboot of Play School's Rocket Clock. But underneath the clock, it's always stockpiles of canned food and ennui. In what has become one of the more anxiety-inducing statements of adulthood, right after "You have a message from MyGov," scientists have updated the time on the Doomsday Clock. So the clock now sits at 90 seconds to midnight. Actually, I'm pretty sure 90 seconds to midnight is the headline band for the sad stage at Metaphors That Are Barely Metaphors Fest. I have to look into that though, I'm not 100% sure. 90 seconds is the closest to midnight the clock has ever been since it was established in 1947. The closest the clock came at the height of the Cold War was only 2 minutes to midnight. And guys, levels of propaganda and internal warmongering were at their highest they had ever been on both sides of the war. And we are beating them. So, yay? We're number one. Number one timeline. This is clearly the beginning of a new era for humanity, our post-apocalyptic age, combining elements of past ages, such as stone and iron, but also a little bit futuristic. Which is perfect, because in a surprisingly prescient move, the Australian government is preparing for just such a future in its latest release of free TAFE courses. As you can see, blacksmithing has been added to the list of 39 new apprenticeship occupations, which have been added to a list this year that will be offered for free. Supposedly based on data collected from Jobs and Skills Australia and the Australian Bureau of Statistics. Now, what data is this that tells us that we don't have enough blacksmiths, equine managers, horse carers, and performance horse managers? Hey, where is this data coming from? What do they know that we don't? I suppose we need someone to make the armor pieces and fuse the desert roaming supercars together so that we can have our blood bag or flaming guitar player leading our war boys across the desert to the new settlements like Bullet Town. These big infrastructure projects don't fund themselves, you know. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm all for some government support, and free TAFE courses for nurses are great. We really need more nurses to burn out, as we haven't really improved the conditions of the work or the pay. So it's a good thing that we're training all of these blacksmiths, because when we run out of people willing to be nurses under the current system in a few years due to the burnout from, you know, all the overwork and underpaid, well, when society reverts to a more primitive time, we won't need nurse training anymore. We'll return to the good old days of leeches, guessing, and alchemy. It's the only way that we'll get anything done, as there will be nobody left to pass on the old knowledge. So maybe as well as blacksmiths, that we should also start investing in alchemists. Might be something in that. 2024 should see a raise in alchemy trainees so that we can get ahead of the situation and start working on the Mad Max world we've always wanted. It's all about future planning and having a vision for this country. Moving on now to alcohol news. Yes, alcohol. The thing white Australia wants to be its culture and personality so much we even made it our first form of currency. It's a tale of two Australias. As first, the Victoria State Government has committed to scrapping public drunkenness laws in the wake of an inquest into the death of an Indigenous woman who hit her head at least 5 times inside a holding cell in 2017. The law reform was slated for November 2022, but was delayed until November this year due to the COVID-19 pandemic. After all, we've been hitting the booze a little harder, not only in lockdown, but afterwards to make up for the whole being in lockdown situation. And drinking while in a bad place leads to poor decisions, and that's a real revenue-raising bonanza for Victoria Police. Basically, it's a drunken public fire sale. This is their last chance to really take advantage of arresting drunks in the streets. They're going to get in while they can. And the great Victorian dictator Dan Andrews himself adopted the new state motto, "Get on the beers." So we've got to follow what the dictator says. Decriminalising public drunkenness was a key recommendation from the Royal Commission into Aboriginal deaths in custody over 30 years ago. And while it seems like a long overdue and barbarically slow outrolling of policy intended to save lives, and the delay has seen 527 Indigenous deaths in custody since the Royal Commission, and that's with deaths of Indigenous people in police cells and vans having increased since the Commission. So, for atrocities against Indigenous communities, they've gone on a real hot streak, downgrading the situation from near-genocidal clusterfuck to merely a race-based whoopsie-doodle. Those are official terms, if you're wondering. You can look them up. Now, some good news, which I know is rare for this show. This change will not see Victoria Police get new powers when public drunkenness is decriminalised. And not to put too fine a point on it, but thank fuck for that. Honestly, according to humanrights.gov.au, the circumstances of deaths in police cells and vans indicated that A, there was a lack of proper assessment procedure and little involvement of medical personnel, including Aboriginal health services. B, there was often no protocol for dealing with intoxicated people, particularly in Queensland and Victoria. C, police officers were insufficiently trained to distinguish intoxication from other injuries. Persons who needed urgent medical help were frequently detained. D, the observation of detainees was often irregular and infrequent. And E, the Aboriginal visitor scheme does not appear to be fully implemented. So they are already failing to implement the powers and responsibilities they have been given. So why would we give them more powers? Why are we continuously rebooting Spider-Man and making them all learn the same harsh lesson that with great power comes great responsibility if we can't hold our cops to that same standard? As you'd expect, criticism has come from the police and ambulance unions. Police Association of Victoria Secretary Wayne Gatt said the union supported the decriminalisation of public drunkenness, but not without replacement powers for police. He said police would not be able to act in a case where someone was drunk, as they can only interfere when an offence has been committed. Wait, so they are saying they want cops to wait until something has already happened before they get involved? What kind of madness is this? I pay my taxes to live in a Minority Report-style super police state where people, particularly non-white and lower-income people, are held to account for actions that we suspect they might take before they take them, and so that I can live in safety in the knowledge that whatever they were going to do was bad and never have to think about them again. Ridiculous. I believe they based it on the refugee system that we have here in Australia. Lock them up before they can cause any problems. That way, they know we aren't messing around. Very smart. But what will we have in place of police powers? I hear you panicking through the screen. Don't worry. We've come through. The laws will be replaced by a health-based approach, where intoxicated people are taken to a sobering up centre or another safe place. So you can see why they are concerned. It's a slippery slope. Once we start to see the cops aren't needed for one scenario, we might start to think, where else do we not need them? Or can their service be circumvented with a different sort of precautionary measure? certainly not in places like the Northern Territory, though, where Anthony Albanese flew into Alice Springs after days of pressure from the federal opposition and the opposition's propaganda wing, the national media, over crime and alcohol-fueled violence in the town. Under the new changes, alcohol sales will also be limited to one transaction per person per day. Mondays and Tuesdays have been designated as takeaway alcohol-free days, with daily opening hours otherwise restricted to between 3 p.m. and 7 p.m. As if Mondays and Tuesdays weren't shit enough, now you can't even undergo the proper way to do Taco Tuesday, with a gentle buzz and the kind of hunger only driven by alcohol consumption. But I think they've really nailed the problem this time. No, I definitely do. I'd be concerned if alcohol is to small towns, particularly indigenous populated towns, what refugees are to the rest of the country. You know, an easy scapegoat to wave in front of the camera, allowing us to neglect much needed systemic examination and expansion of support for systems to help maintain the basic needs of regional towns. It's governmental catnip. They are obsessed with it. Meow, 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 meow. And certainly a group representing the town's Aranite traditional owners haven't been saying the current crisis was a result of intervention policies and decades of chronic and systemic neglect of remote communities. No, no, that couldn't possibly be that. I always hear politicians banging on about how they love the regions and how they wouldn't let them fall into neglect and disrepair. So it must be something else. It has to be. It must be something different between the majority populations of Victoria and the Northern Territory, but I can't quite put my finger on it. What it is, though. It's a shame that it isn't as clear as black and white. Oh well, I'll keep working on it, I guess. And finally, checking in with RoboDebt News. RoboDebt, if you listen to this podcast, you know by now. But for the newbies, RoboDebt is the piñata filled with poor people that the government would occasionally hit when they needed some extra cash. The RoboDebt Royal Commission has been renewed for a 2023 season, and it is slowly turning into my favourite true crime documentary. As the true horrors of the welfare system's indifference towards the most vulnerable among us have been put on display. Like it's an Australian remake of American Horror Story, or the newest version of Underbelly. Underbelly, bureaucracy. Former DHS Chief Counsel Annette Musolino told a RoboDebt Royal Commission the $1.8 billion RoboDebt scheme relied on a hit-and-miss approach, despite 2014 DSS legal advice it would not be lawful to use average Australian tax office income data. This was all backed by a single piece of internal legal advice based entirely on a vibe, a classic Australian legal strategy laid down by Working Dog v. Funding for Larger Films.
In summing up, it's the Constitution, it's Mabo, it's justice, it's law, it's the vibe, and no, that's it, it's the vibe. I rest my case.
That was sensational.
The Commission heard senior executives at the Department of Human Services began contemplating getting external advice after a wave of adverse media coverage in late 2016 and early 2017, which included a draft set of instructions that qualified the lawfulness of appropriating income to raise debts under the scheme. Now, as you can probably guess by the fact that the fan has successfully spread all of the shit around, which was then driven in by the Roomba, who spread it around just a little bit further with all of the grace of a rhinoceros ice skating, no legal review was undertaken. I believe this harkens back to Law 101 ignorance of a crime is always an excuse. Pretty sure that's how that goes. After the Solicitor General's 2019 advice declaring this scheme could not definitively rely on averaging data, Stuart, $37 million government dollars directed into a company that you had personal interest in, Robert, the Minister for Government Services and Misappropriation of Funds, was told senior officials faced considerable legal risk if the program was continued. So he was told not nearly as much risk as the people who received the debts, mind you, and tried to publicly fight them, and certainly no personal or long-term impacting risk, but some risk. Some risk is better than no risk, I suppose. But if we're to compare levels of risk, if welfare recipients receiving a robo-debt are people walking a tightrope with a team of people cutting the net underneath them, well, then the government are the people cutting the rope. Sure, one of those welfare recipients might land on top of them, but they'll have a team of people giving them ample warning, and they are, after all, wearing those little spiked helmets, so I'm pretty sure they'll be fine. This advice included a tort of public misfeasance, which, if like me, you recognize those words but want it explained simply, means they have acted unlawfully in the sense that they exceeded or misused a public power or position. Also, possible breaches of the Public Governance, Performance and Accountability Act. So that is the law which requires public servants to behave honestly and ethically, which is apparently a thing. Who knew? Looking at any of these governments, who knew? That really is a law that could do with a little bit more enforcing. We may have let that one atrophy a little bit over time, you know what I mean. At the Robodebt Royal Commission's third hearing block, we saw this on display. The Robodebt Royal Commissioner, an adult in the room, Catherine Holmes, summed up the evidence so far. Everybody says it was really somebody else's doing, and it's a bit hard to get to the bottom of whose doing it was. A bit worrisome. And I can see why, looking back over the hearing. First up, we have Ministers Alan Tudge and Christian Porter, the disastrous duo. It's been a delight to have someone that they can't talk down to or back to without consequence, because these people have the power to tell it how it is.
You don't seem to have approached any of this from a lawyer's point of view, really, do you? You don't seem to have at any stage said, well, by what authority do we send the letters, or by what authority do we average, or by what authority do we impose the penalty?
When Porter was asked if he accepted any responsibility for the scheme, the former social services minister definitely did his share of deflecting.
And I appreciate that in these circumstances, there was controversy around it, but there were many controversial programs.
Before doing the unthinkable for a minister, facing the possibility of consequences, taking some form of responsibility, saying, I look back on this and I see myself through the correspondence, and getting quite close at points to taking the next step of inquiry. I didn't do that. I wish now that I had, but I also see the reasons that I didn't. Ooh, so close to taking responsibility, just so close. Among the reasons, Porter, who, it's worth noting, has left politics, said that he didn't ask more questions about the scheme's legality is his recollection that in early 2017, someone assured him it was legal. I mean, he couldn't exactly recall who said it was legal, but said it was a public servant, so definitely someone. And he's brought a claim that he didn't turn his mind to the legality of the scheme. I have to assume his confidence comes from Royal Commissions having a history of not exactly seeing punishment and consequence laid out for those exposed. As a lawyer, Porter would know, while humiliating in the moment, this too shall pass unpunished. Given the 1991 Royal Commission into Indigenous Affairs produced 110 reports, 10,000 pages of script, 339 recommendations were made, and the Commonwealth government promised $400 million towards the implementation of the recommendations in 1992. And while many of them have been implemented, nothing has changed. Literally nothing has... The number of deaths has gone up. So if anything, that's the only thing that's changed, really. Since the report was handed down, more than 450 Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander people have died in custody. An Amnesty International report highlighted the issue as well as widespread support for raising the age of criminal responsibility from 10 to 14. Policy, like so many others, that disproportionately impacts Indigenous citizens, whose youth make up the majority of the young people in prison. But unlike many other areas of neglect, Robodebt did in fact impact people who weren't Indigenous, even going so far as to impact some white people. There was always a better chance something will actually come of it. Though, the white people that were impacted are still poor. So, maybe it'll fall under the category of, we made a big public display, we made recommendations, what more can you expect? God! As for the former Human Services Minister Alan Tudge, well, that's a horseshit of a different colour. Over 1.5 days, Tudge insisted that he had laser-like focus on fixing the practical problems of the scheme. And here is footage of Tudge demonstrating his powerful laser.
Please be careful. You don't want to be in the way when my laser goes off.
Hey, a laser! How come you don't have a laser, Woody?
It's not a laser. It's a little light bulb that blinks.
What's with him?
Laser envy.
Tudge said that he was never told about the legal doubts officials in his department held about the scheme. He had no reason to believe the scheme was unlawful because it had gone through cabinet. We all know nothing bad has ever gone successfully through cabinet. So who was responsible for all this lack of a device? PricewaterhouseCooper, the government favourite place to dump money that isn't one of their own businesses, was commissioned to do a report reviewing Robodebt in 2017. But weirdly, they can't recall if it was finalised or why that might be if it wasn't.
How do you get to a point just at the time you've almost got it finalised where it's then clear that a presentation you've given a couple of weeks earlier will fit the bill?
Yeah, I don't recall the conversation. Sorry.
Catherine Holmes said the evidence of Shane West challenges credulity and that a nod and a wink may have been given to bury the firm's report that had been commissioned. So effectively, PwC was paid not to deliver the Robodebt report, to never finalise it, to keep it in draft form so that nobody had to be accountable. Reportedly, a $10 million report was shelved. A $10 million report designed to suss out if money was being wasted by welfare. That was never quite finalised in order that PwC can try to avoid being accountable for its advice and that the government, who commissioned it, wouldn't be accountable for commissioning it. More importantly, as the report was shelved before it was finalised, it was effectively buried, unable to be accessed under Freedom of Information laws by the public. So if the government is just handing out $10 million for not finishing work to make them feel good, I'm open to taking that money. I could have not finished this episode for a mere $8 million. That is a $2 million saving right there, and I know you're looking to save some money. The people would never have heard about this from me, and we'd all be better off, I think. I don't know. Tudge rejected the suggestion that if those public servants had not sought to clarify the law on Robodebt, which they didn't, he was responsible as the minister. So, he is responsible by his own twisty logic. Good, that's good to know. Under questioning, he even conceded that he never suggested it be stopped either. So he deliberately didn't do the right thing, which I believe is the major charge levelled against Robodebt recipients, if I'm not wrong. Except they didn't even have evidence against them for doing the wrong thing or for failing to do the wrong thing for which they got charged. Okay, I think I'm following. And as a law student, he would know the number one rule, ignorance of the law is always an excuse. I do believe that's how that goes. I believe so. Oh, what's that? That's not what it says. Oh, well, that's embarrassing. Well, what does it say then? Oh, ignorance of the law excuses not. Well, that's written poorly. Surely we can update the language on that. Well, how long has that been in the law anyway? How long has that been a rule? What do you mean, since always? Well, he wouldn't know that, would he? As he...
I was never admitted to the law. I didn't practice law.
It's in our criminal code, you insist, as I continue doing this bit. But not only that, it has a cultural touchstone back to Aristotle and the Bible. What? That's crazy. Well, it's not like he worked under an extremely religious zealot who used religion as a shield for all of his actions. So, I think this one slides, if I'm honest with you. I think you've been a bit too hard on old touch there. Okay. Yeah. We'll get back to me later. Move it or something. Alan Tudge's former media advisor and woman who has shown absolutely no repentance for her role in this mess, but gotten an undeserving hero's welcome, Rochelle Miller, told the Royal Commission she devised the strategy to place stories in friendly media, i.e. the Murdoch Press, after being told to shut down the Media Storm, also known as people daring to defend themselves from unjust accusations of thievery, bludgery, and doing activities that would normally get a politician promoted in early 2017. Miller said she was confident the story could be shut down, and where you are friends with 63% of the media, that is a confident position to hold. The plan she devised meant placing stories in more friendly media, which she described as right-wing media, naming the Australian newspaper and the tabloids, as well as A Current Affair and talkback stations such as 2GB. Now, I know that some of you are out here standing her, but I won't hear it. She is a company bootlegger who was more than happy to use her dark arts to punish the poor for standing up for themselves, and spoke up because ultimately she was just following orders and stood no chance to see repercussions for her actions. Not only that, she had an axe to grind, because she's the recipient of $650,000 in a settlement for hurt, distress, and humiliation she alleges she suffered while working for former ministers Alan Tudge and Michaela Cash. So forgive me if I don't exactly trust her or her intentions. I'm obviously not with News Corp, who will attack her. But there is a space between the two extremes, where she is both a victim of one crime and helped perpetuate another. More than likely, someone in a similar position of power and influence will hire her, as they have seen that she is unscrupulous with even the most vulnerable, and that she will be paid nicely to destroy someone who doesn't deserve it. So no, she doesn't exactly get my sympathies, nor does she get my praises for this particular one. Because people like that, they've seen that she's willing to do what it takes, including tracking down debts from the period when Labor was in government, which had not been detected at the time, to continue their one and only defense. Oh yeah, but Labor did it as well. So apparently if Labor does the thing, it is okay for them to be 4,000 times worse. But then not only did they not find any, they also couldn't find a demand letter to a Robodebt victim with a useful phone number attached to it.
Mr. Ryman, do you recognise this document as the pro forma standard initial letter that was used in the OCI program?
Yes, I do.
Okay. And then gives a web address, my.gov.au?
Yes.
Doesn't give a phone number? Do you see that?
Yes.
Can you tell us why a phone number wasn't included?
I recall that the phone number wasn't included because we were really seeking customers to go online.
Honestly, if you went into a store and they engaged with you the way Centrelink does, you'd burn the place to the ground and then hang around until the police arrived so that you can make sure they knew it was you. She was also willing to follow through on this despicable act, like she was some sort of less entertaining Malcolm Tucker, the head of the media in the thick of it, acquiring the file of every single person who appeared in the media so we could understand the details of their case and obtain other case studies that were also used to create data sets for the tabloid media. Ooh, what a great person she is. Even gathering select pieces of information from personal files provided by the department's office and giving them to some journalists in the friendly media in an effort to correct the record in the media following negative stories about individuals who'd received a RoboDebt notice. Going on to say with a disturbing amount of blasé, the effect was there was less people speaking out in the media, which was the intention. Man, what a hero. People's fucking champion of the year right there. Miller said she was aware of media reports that connected the RoboDebt scheme to the suicide of debt recipients, saying in general, there was a lack of empathy in the office. Whew. A lack of empathy for suicide victims. They were so heartless about it all, they were probably thinking, well, that money is a write-off, but if more bludgers kill themselves, that's less people on the dole. That'll get us back in surplus in no time. You're welcome, Australia. She said the media strategy was deployed after attempts at pushing counter-narratives about the scheme were unsuccessful and groups of journalists reporting on RoboDebt at the time became, quote, vindictive. They remained blissfully unaware that they, the people driving people to commit suicide, were the bad guys and not the victims of this scheme. Those were the people who were unlawfully and unjustly attacked. Doesn't it suck when a cuttingly accurate but equally horrible rumor about you gets back to you? I know, it's a terrible feeling. It's like hearing your voice on tape for the first time, but you thought that you were recording yourself saying, we're trying to balance the budget, when you were actually saying, string up the poor and beat them like money piñatas, and if they die in the process, publicly shame them for getting caught up in being poor in the first place. And you think, well, my voice doesn't sound like that, does it? Does it? No, certainly not. Look, here's the thing. The system is atrocious and should never have been birthed into public policy. But now that it exists, well, it's time for the powerful to feel the pinch. We know, through the revelations of the Royal Commission, that all involved with implementing the scandal are, in fact, guilty. So each of the team members involved will be given an algorithmically generated prison sentence. The onus of innocence will be on the ministers and public servants to prove they are in fact innocent and get themselves out of jail. They will also be billed the full $1.8 billion that was paid out to the RoboDebt victims to help balance the damage done to the public purse. After all, they are so obsessed with balance and fairness, they shouldn't have an issue with any of this. I suspect that they will suddenly start remembering some of the names of accomplices and people who gave them advice. They'll find the missing emails and the advice that is plaguing the Royal Commission. Quick smart. And it'd be good to apply this system of quote-unquote justice to big gas and oil companies who have caused climate damage and covered it up, which has led to extreme weather events and natural disasters that helped drive an increase in the price of fruit and vegetables recently. The damaging weather also disrupted the mining, agriculture, tourism, and construction sectors, all major sections of the Australian economy. But, come on now, come on, be fair, be fair. How bad could it have been? you cry from the other side of the screen. Why should we sick the vicious robot dead boogie monster on our friends, the oil and gas industries? Well, seems data has been released by the Insurance Council of Australia in November, and that showed the insurance bill for storms and floods since January 2020 has topped $12.3 billion. $12.3 billion! The New South Wales and South East Queensland floods of February and March in 2022 alone accounted for $5.65 billion worth of claims. So altogether, that is 17 times what they were seeking to get back from welfare recipients. All being fair, and this being the country of the fair go, it's time to stick this kind of treatment that they unleashed on the poor and the powerless without a second thought on the top end of town. Robodebt may turn into the most effective means of keeping the powerful online, as it can't be bribed, it can't be bargained with, it can't be reasoned with, it doesn't feel pity or remorse or fear, it absolutely will not stop ever. You will have paid your debt or you will have committed suicide. Now, that was a bit of a bleak way to end the episode, I understand that, but we have reached the end and I do appreciate you sticking around. I really hope that you enjoyed as much of that as you could. Please, if you did enjoy it, or if you enjoy the work that we do here, I have live shows coming up and I'd love for you to come out and support the podcast by coming out and seeing the live shows. As I've said, Wellington Fringe, Newcastle Fringe, Melbourne International Comedy Festival, and Edinburgh Fringe with Wage Against the Machine, San Diego International Fringe Festival with I Got Bit by a Monkey Once, so please come out and support the show. Join the Patreon if that's more your thing. Share it around. Give it a nice review, 5 stars or 1 star. These are your options. It's either 5 stars or 1 star, you coward. But thank you so much for sticking around to the end, and I'll see you next time. Bye!